Okay, so it's July 24th, 2015. My name is Rachel Gelfand. And we're in the offices of
the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's what you do want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Betty Barnard, and I am, well, right now I'm the Planning and Policy Development Specialist, and I guess I just said that automatically because I'm at work. So, that's, yeah, maybe you didn't need to know that for the interview.
No, but this is where we're meeting you at. So, we're going to start just with a little bit about your background. So where are you from? Where did you grow up? The first question here is, what do you remember about your grandparents on either side?
Oh.
So, as far back as you want to go.
Okay. I was born and raised in Pensacola, Florida, on the Gulf Coast, in the Florida Panhandle. And I remember a lot about my grandparents because my family is pretty close-knit. And both of my parents worked, so my paternal grandmother took care of my brother and I a lot. I have a brother who's 2 years younger. Would pick us up from like day school or preschool, and then we would stay with her a lot. And my maternal grandmother, even though she wasn't as involved in raising me, we all lived in the same neighborhood at first, and then they moved out. Whereas my grandmother took a little bit longer to move out, but Granny and Grandsir. Grandsir is my mom's stepdad.
Mm-hmm.
We're also like really close with our family, and I spend a lot of time with them. And I still am. I'm much closer. I just have a closer bond, I think, with my granny. But Grandsir died in 2011, so I don't know. They're really interesting people. Like, my granny was born in Southern Missouri, and I don't know who my paternal grandfather is. Well, I do, but I haven't ever met him before. Apparently, he still lives in Albuquerque. But I was going to say something, and then I forgot what it was related to. Oh, so related to like the feminist aspect of the purpose of the interview. Like, both of my grandmothers, even though I don't think they would openly identify as being feminists per se, have always had jobs throughout their entire lives, even when they were raising their kids. I think my paternal grandmother for a little while didn't have a job, but they both worked. And when, I know through my father at least, that when Roe v. Wade, the decision was passed down, at least at that time, both of my grandmothers expressed like pro-choice views, so to speak. I think now they're both like fundamentalist Southern Baptists, so they may not. They may not cop to that, or their views may have changed very radically. I haven't talked to them about that issue, but I do. I know that about them, and I think that. When I found that out in high school, that sort of gave me some courage in doing the work that I was doing, and like the bulk of the work I've done in the feminist movement being with like reproductive rights, health, and justice.
Mm-hmm. What was their work?
What were their jobs?
Yeah.
I'm not sure what all my grandma did, but or my granny, but when Grandsir started a construction company '70s or something, Granny became his bookkeeper and like operations manager, and then she did that for like the rest of her career. And even though she's been retired for over a decade now, she's basically has still been involved in that and now runs his business now that he's deceased, along with my uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And Grandma worked at first with a telephone company with Southern Bell, which is no longer in existence, but was later an educator and then worked for the Escambia County School Board, which is the Pensacola's in Escambia County.
So what was it like growing up in Pensacola?
Pensacola is a really, was going to say militaristic town, but that's not the term I'm looking for. It is a military town. Like, there is a large naval air station base there. There's also a lot of bases up and down the coast, too, especially in the Panhandle, but there's a big one there where all branches of the military will send their pilots to train for naval aviation. And it's also a very historic town. It's one of the oldest continuously occupied cities in North America, and it's been it's like the city of Five Flags, I think, or maybe it's six. Which one's the theme park? Six?
Six.
So it's the city of Five Flags.
Six is Texas, I think.
It's like the state of Six Flags or something like that?
Yeah.
Or, okay. But yeah, it's been colonized by, like, the Spanish, the French, the British, and then not really colonized by, but well, sort of, by Confederate and the United States flag, yeah. I don't know why, I just, that was like a mental exercise. But, so it's really old, it's on the coast, there's a lot of military folks there, so it's kind of a transient city. At the same time, it's also a very historical city. So those are two interesting things in opposition to one another. It's hot as hell, it's right on the water, which I love and miss. It's like the major population demographics, so like there's a lot of white people, there's a lot of black people, there's also huge Vietnamese and Greek populations, mostly because I think like after the war in Vietnam, when people resettled to America, like they wanted to be on the coast too. They were like, oh, this is kind of like home and it's cheap. And for Greek people, I've heard the same thing. They're mm-hmm. like, you know, coming to America, they want to be on a similar, like, warm climate on the coast.
Did you move? Did your family go there for the military, naval?
I don't think so. I don't know. I can never remember why my mom's side of the family moved there. My dad's side. I think that his father, who died before I was, way before I was born, was assigned there through his job. He was a land surveyor, and he had been living in Georgia and went to UGA for his graduate education, I think, and then he was a land surveyor here, then they moved him to Pensacola.
So did you do activism in high school, or?
Yeah, that's how I got started. So being that it's very military heavy, it's also a lot of people have very conservative political values. Not that those two things necessarily go hand in hand, but it's a pretty good barometer. And I always felt like I was in opposition politically to almost everyone that I met. And I cannot say why, to be honest, because my parents are both Republicans and always have been since, like, I became aware of politics, but I just never agreed with that, and I always gravitated towards, like, left and radical, like, social and political views and issues. And when I was in high school, my freshman year, I had this awesome teacher who taught this class called Inquiry Skills, which basically is, like, research skills. And she was also the faculty liaison for the Young Feminist Alliance. So I started going to these meetings, and I immediately felt like I had found a home and, like, a meaning for, like, what I might possibly do in my life or my education. And for her class, she also did service learning projects. So I did stuff with, like, fundraising for domestic violence shelters and for AIDS relief organizations, and then we did debates. And I remember the debate project I did was actually like a pro-life versus pro-choice thing, and even though I picked pro-choice, I was assigned to it, I can't remember what, I actually struggled with it a lot, which is why the reproductive justice framework, learning about that later, made so much sense, learning about like how it's not just a dichotomous black and white issue, how it's really complex, and that there's room for more than one, for many different views mm-hmm. on abortion, what it means to people. But all that to say, that was, I think, maybe the first time I had meaningfully encountered that issue. And then I was in the IB program, the International Baccalaureate program at that high school. And part of the IB curriculum is that you have to do a service project. And I can't remember what the exact figures are, but you're supposed to do, I think it's 150 hours of general community service doing whatever, and then you do 100 hours of a very focused project with just one, you know, mm-hmm. one organization or one purpose. And I had kept being involved in YFA, and I had kind of honed in on reproductive health and reproductive rights as being, like, to me it was very central to feminism, because I guess as, like, a cisgender, like, heterosexual woman, I felt like the reproductive, women's reproductive capacity seemed to be so central in oppression. And the only organization I could find, like, any sort of collective working on this issue in Pensacola was the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. And I learned so much from them. I learned that Pensacola had been the site of, I think, like, a couple of different clinic bombings since then, even in the last couple of years. One has been burned down. I'm not even sure there is an abortion provider in Pensacola anymore. There used to be a couple, several, and now there were two, and now there are none, I think. Sorry, I feel like I'm missing.
Maybe not. That's a lot of pressure.
It's a tense moment. Two doctors have been killed there, and a clinic escort. And I didn't know this about Pensacola's history, so that was really interesting and sad and motivating to learn about that. And that group, the Pensacola RCRC, had formed out of the clinic bombings and harsh political climate in, like, the late 80s and the 90s, where this violence had also occurred, at the time this violence had also occurred. And they had kept going, and they were, for the most part, pretty aged. They were, like, the members were age range 60 to 80. So, I mean, I was, like, a golden child. Rachel loved me.
You were, like, 6, 7, 8.
I was, like, 16, 17. Yeah. And they were, like, you care about this?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh, come sit next to me. Like, let me talk to tell you all about it. Here's some cookies. Like, they were thrilled that I wanted to get involved. So I worked with them, like, doing some organizing, and went out to try to visit some clinics in Mobile and take, like, an informal census, so to speak, of what services were available along that stretch of the Gulf Coast. Mobile is only, like, 45 minutes to an hour away from Pensacola, uh-huh. so it's the closest
city.
Option
uh-huh.
if a woman somebody can't get an abortion in Pensacola. It's really funny to think about it in retrospect, because I didn't do shit. I mean, like, I tried to, and I thought I was doing stuff, but yeah, but I can't tell you what the outcomes of any of that were. It was like,
mm-hmm.
maybe a waste of time.
So you've already answered a lot of these questions of sort of
cool.
role models. There was this teacher
mm-hmm.
who, in your high school, and then you had this older generation sort of ushering you in.
Yeah.
How did that, then we met, you went to college, I met you, I think, right
yeah.
when you got to college, I think, right?
You were my sister.
Yeah,
my
right.
big sib.
So we were, I mean, you know, I think, you know, personal relationship should be on the record. So you came, I met you, then, I don't know, when, so you kind of found, there's a question here, how did you find the feminist movement? And it sounds like somewhat in high school you were finding reproductive justice.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because I think I could say that I found it through that teacher, mentor person was Sarah Cohan. I I may have found it through her in a way, and then the person I had the deepest relationship with at the RCRC was Priscilla Lamour, which is, isn't that an amazing name?
Mm-hmm.
She's an amazing lady too.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really took a break from it in college, so to speak, and stepped back from any sort of activism or even identifying as a feminist for the most part. I took one gender studies class, and then I was like, I just went off on another direction. Part of it was intentional, another part was just completely unintentional. But then I got involved with escorting when I moved home after college, with clinic escorting. But I think that the process of discovering feminism, so to speak, has been like continual and ongoing. Like, I learn so much about it constantly, and I learn about the different feminisms that people have and what it means to them, and I feel like I kind of soak in what resonates with me, or what
mm-hmm.
I feel like when others' stories resonate with me too, and I come to see, like, become an ally, or whatever the best term might be now. Like, I used to be, this is hard to admit, but it's true, but I used to, like, I totally didn't understand transgender issues at all. Like, I remember even at Smith encountering the first people I met who transitioned to being male and to that gender expression, and I was like, what the fuck? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that? And, like, refusing to call people by their preferred pronouns or names and just being really insensitive. And since then, like, learning about that, and also, again, like, hard to say but true, just like having, you know, in other encounters with transgender people, especially with trans women working at the Feminist Center,
mm-hmm.
And learning about their struggle and how they can't get care there and why that was important and detrimental to the center as being part of the movement here. Yeah, I think I've done a complete 180 on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's now something that's part of my feminism that hadn't been before. It's just occurred over the last, like, 5 years or so. So I think, like, discovering feminism is constantly evolving, and that keeps it exciting, and it keeps it, like, fresh in my mind and central in my life, definitely.
The next question is, like, what were the major social and political issues you remember debating in college? And that's one of them. Trans politics was definitely a big thing. And I don't know what else you'd want to include in that question. But
I think probably the, like, sexual orientation politics too. But I don't know if for me it was ever, like, an academic debate, so to speak, or how was it worded?
Yeah,
like
what it says debate, but, you know, what was sort of the political questions of the time?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those definitely were, like, debated questions. I just think for me, because I had my head up my ass, it was just, like, you know, things that would be discussed on a more personal and social level. It wasn't in the forefront of my political consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever I had at that point in time.
Yeah. But also, like, I didn't take any women and gender studies classes when I was at Smith, and I think part of that was, like, there's so much already going on.
Mm-hmm.
I just, like, steered away from it, even though I don't know why. It's just sort of what I did. So then you moved home after college.
Mm-hmm.
And what'd you do?
And when I moved home, almost immediately, I moved in with two of my best friends from high school and got a job on Craigslist. It was like one of the coolest jobs I've ever had. It was only for about 3 months, but these people in Jacksonville had a visual real estate company. Like, it's kind of creepy. They were filming. They affixed a camera to the top of my car that was in, like, a plastic black trunk, so it looked very...
Sketchy,
yeah, is the right word. And I drove slowly around Pensacola smoking a lot of weed and listening to classic rock and filming everything, because it was like this camera was in this black trunk, and then there were camera lenses on, like, all sides of that trunk, like, two on each side, and then one in the front and back, so it was, like, a complete view of mm-hmm. wherever I was driving. And,
bizarre.
Really bizarre. So I only had that job for, like, 3 months before they laid everyone off. And then I started working at a coffee shop, and connected with some really awesome women who were, like, going to the local university, and some of them were doing art, and they all identified as feminists, and, like, half of them had had abortions before, and were really into, like, what I had been into politically and socially, but were also incorporating this artistic element that I don't think I'd ever connected the dots with before, even though, like, a lot of the music and art I liked in high school was, like, you know, Riot Girl, like, Bikini Kill kind of stuff. I never thought of it as being as related or, like, that could be a political outlet for people locally. So that part was really neat. And I don't consider myself to be, like, a creative person either, so I like being around people who mm-hmm. think like that. So that kind of fed me. And then I started escorting at a clinic, and my boyfriend at the time started escorting with me too, and that's what love is, even though that didn't work out. But I think that, like, political activism uh-huh. and that kind of, like, I don't want to go down that road. That was really awesome of him, is all I want to say about
that. So what did you do? You stood outside, and when someone showed up, you just walked with them inside?
Mm-hmm.
Or?
So the setup was horrible at that clinic. It's the one that got burnt down a couple of years ago. But the parking lot was incredibly tiny, and there was a huge tree in the middle of the lot. So people had to, like, they would come in this fence from the street, have to, like, drive around it.
Uh-huh.
you can see clearly.
Yeah. Graph.
There's the tree in the middle, and then they would have to come in and drive in a loop around and, like, drop off the patient, and if she had somebody going with her, drop her off, and the clinic building was, like, right here. And then pretty much parked inside were, like, just staff. Like, there were just a few parking spaces where clients could go. Mm-hmm. So what eventually ended up happening is that, like, at first the escorts would just kind of let them in and sort of help shield the clients and walk them to the door if they wanted and just be, like, a calming, supportive presence. Because the protesters were out here on the sidewalk, like, yelling things through the gap in the fence. But eventually we started doing, like, a valet thing, where as escorts we would, like, the driver and the client would get out, and then we would drive their car across the street to a shopping center parking lot, and then we would have to walk back through the protester gauntlet across this really busy, big, like, street in Pensacola, so that they would, you know, it was much safer for them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Much safer for the clients and their drivers. So that was every Friday morning from, like, 6 a.m. to 11 a.m., and then we'd go to the Pensacola Diner and eat some brunch. And the guy who led that effort was Bill Kaplinger, and he had been doing it basically since, like, before Dr. Gunn and James Barrett, the escort, got killed in 90, whenever it was. So he'd been doing it a long-ass time, for, like, 20 years, and he kept doing it up until the point it got burned down.
Hmm. So what were your other positions doing reproductive justice?
So that experience, like, working at the cafe and then being involved with those local women, like, we started our own contemporary women's collective. Like, we're going to do some organizing around that and volunteering at the clinic. And then I realized, like, what am I doing here? I was drinking and, like, smoking a lot of weed and was like, this is not... Even though I feel like there's an outlet for other things, I'm not living a healthy life or advancing myself here. So I moved to San Francisco and started working for NAROL Pro Choice California. And then from there, I moved to their national office in D.C. And at NAROL Pro Choice California, that was a really good experience because even though I was an office manager, I got to support all aspects of their organization, like with development and marketing and lobbying, like helping the executive director to manage their political action committee that like raised funds for pro-choice candidates and just learning more about the political process, mm-hmm. that aspect of it.
Was that like 2008.
That was like for 5 months in 2008. I was living in San Francisco. And then I moved to D.C. like right after Thanksgiving of 2008 and was the affiliate affairs associate. And so NAROL had like 23 state affiliates across the country. And what I really wanted to do ultimately was to be back in the South and support the people doing this work in the southern region. Georgia at the time was the last affiliate standing, unless you count Texas, which I guess is technically southern in a lot of ways. But
it's all southern to me. Massachusetts.
Yeah.
We used to say Philly is the South.
Well, it depends on where you are.
Yeah.
So the Southeast, though, is different.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Texas is Southwest. I really wanted to be doing stuff in the Southeast, and Georgia folded, like, right before I got there. And I was like, I'm on a mission. I'm going to support these state affiliates. On the level at which such important political things are happening that are rapidly going the wrong way. And then I got laid off, like, almost immediately. Within like 6 weeks, they had a big round of layoffs. The economy tanked. They laid off like 12 other people, and I was like, shit, fuck, like I moved across the country. I gave up a permanent position at the California office to be here. What the hell am I gonna do? I'm gonna go to grad school,
mm-hmm.
get back in the South. Mm-hmm. So I went to UGA. I started that in August of 2009. And I did a dual Master's of Nonprofit Management and Women and Gender Studies certificate program. So that took me 2 years. And then I interned with a couple of different places, but most of my internship credit time was with the Feminist Center. And then my last semester, summer semester of 2011, I was interning at the center's clinic and then started working part-time as the grassroots organizer, which I eventually became like that part morphed into my job there, like as the community engagement coordinator. And then while I was at UGA, I was like abortion girl. Like every single paper and project was on abortion.
Mm-hmm.
And I also I was involved with the Women's Studies Student Organization, was the treasurer and then the co-facilitator and then the Choice USA liaison. Choice USA is now entirely, I can't remember the name of the organization. They moved away from that like choice language to some like more reproductive justice framework.
Mm-hmm.
And started an abortion fund and volunteer support network with a woman I met through WSSO.
What's an abortion fund?
It is, in our case, it's a nonprofit, but it's just like a collective of people who pool resources or fundraise to help people pay for abortions or related mm-hmm. costs, like the travel, the lodging, if they need it, the medication, things like that.
So you started that with other people there?
Yeah, so April and I started that in 2011, and then we found another person to be on the board. We knew we needed at least 3 people on paper to incorporate in the state of Georgia. And then we got nonprofit status through the National Network of Abortion Funds. And then we got our first agreement set up with the Feminist Center, like using the relationships I had built there. We got a sort of like an MOU signed. And then because I started working there, it became apparent after, I think it took like about a year for me to realize that that was a conflict of interest and that I couldn't do both of those things. Because we were like trying to fund those their clients and also like help them to get abortions. And so the clinic staff would like get pissed at me and or call me at my job asking for help. And I was like, I got to keep these two things separate.
Yeah.
And then finally was like, actually, I can't do both at the same time. So I stepped down and now I just fund them, not fund them, but donate to them. And now there's another brand new organization here that for a while I had a hard time understanding. I need to learn more about it, but I was upset when I heard that they were forming because I was like, why don't they just, why don't we join forces? Why don't you just join our board and help out with that? But from what I understand, it's an organization that's like created and run by and for women of color. And if they need their own space and organization to do that work, then more power to them. And it's actually Georgia and the organization I started that should help them, and probably take that as a wake-up call to like look inside and figure out how to become more diverse and like reflect the people we serve, because most of the people that the fund serves, at least when I was there, was like women of color. And yet all the women on the board since it was formed and to my knowledge ever since have been white women. I think with maybe like one or two exceptions. So.
And what kind of work do you do here? Briefly, I don't want to.
Yeah, now I'm, I am a planning and policy development specialist is my title, but the way I explain it is that I'm a program manager for several federal funding streams for crime victim services. And the bulk of the agencies that we fund are child advocacy centers, sexual assault centers, and DV, domestic violence shelters. And so I definitely bring like my lens and my experience as a feminist and an activist to this work. I think almost all the work we do can be linked back to like gender-based violence and social justice issues and inequalities. And that's, yeah, that's what I do.
So you're sort of like, you've been on both sides of, you know, the funding, being a nonprofit that's applying for funding and then being on the side of funding going towards organizations.
Yeah, and here specifically that's definitely the case, because I work at a state agency that's a pass-through entity for federal funds. So I apply to the feds for these funds and then I make requests for applications or instructions, whatever you want to call them, for locally based agencies to apply to get those federal funds.
There's a question, what keeps you up at night in this section?
Really? Is that, I assume that's related to feminism?
No, or? It's just sort of like in your career, or we can move on. I skipped it with one interview and they were like, what keeps me up at night is blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, that's a really good, interesting question, actually. But the next section is sort of like a few sort of issues that are kind of current political issues, but yeah, I don't know if you want to respond to it. What keeps you up at night?
I mean, what keeps me up at night is like probably unfortunately not related to feminism.
Yeah.
It's like I really want to move on from my job here right now. I don't know why I'm being quiet, and my boss actually knows. I told her point blank. Yeah, I think the things that keep me up at night are more personal. But when I was really into my work and thinking about it creatively, it was like, what, and I hope that other funders are thinking about this too, but like, what can I do to make it easier on the grant recipients to manage this money? Like, how can I make it simpler for them to get and use this effectively so that they can serve more people? Yeah, I think I was actually just talking to a colleague this morning about like the increase in funds for reproductive justice work in the Southeast that I've seen recently, and how it's both encouraging and frustrating at the same time to see that huge increase. It feels like it's like they're pouring a lot of money into something that I'm like, is it too little or too little too late?
Mm-hmm.
Like, have they've been ignoring us for like decades, and in a lot of ways I think also writing us off.
Mm-hmm.
And now they want to pour their dollars into it. Like, to what extent will the people who live here actually have autonomy and discretion to use that funds as they see fit, as opposed to these funders in like, you know, California or the Northeast?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have the flexibility to use this money in ways that our communities actually need it and not just what they think we need? So, I don't know, time will tell with that, or if it's a trend, or if it'll be something long term that we can make like sustainable change about.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting that money's coming in. A lot of this is sort of like, what funding issues shape the work that you do? Or assuming that there's no money, that like, there is the crash and now there's less funding, but there's actually money coming in, I guess, for reproductive justice.
In the Southeast, yeah, I've seen like a significant uptick. And then I think recently I've also seen a lot of positions at national organizations become open too, like with CLIP or with the National Network of Abortion Funds or with some like RJ Foundation.
So how would you say the economic crash affected you, or?
Oh my God, it affected me so much. I mean, like, I got laid off from NARAL. Like, NARAL downsized a lot. I think, like, coming to Georgia, it definitely, I think it affected my financial aid. It also, like, starting the abortion fund at the same time, I saw how much it was affecting people locally and like people's ability to pay for and access abortion services. It definitely impacted the Feminist Center a lot too. They were like, they had some really lean times. The salaries still, I think, remain like very low and stagnant for the staff there. I think it also lowered the amount of funds they could get for like full paying clients, as opposed to like, and clients with insurance, as opposed to like providing discounted services or grant funded services. So I think it put a huge strain on people's resources on multiple levels.
So how did you just were going to your office and then you got like a memo that we're laying off?
No, it was
how did you find out you were being downsized?
It was a Friday afternoon. It was Friday before Obama's inauguration, so we actually had that Monday off, because was it MLK Day?
It was really cold. I went to D.C., and I remember it was, like, January.
It was super cold, too. I do remember that for sure. We were downstairs going through the NARAL's, like, archive storage area in the building, wearing our sweaters and jackets because it was cold down there too. And yeah, we were going through all these files, and then our director came downstairs and was like, everybody upstairs are going to the conference room for a meeting. And then my position was union, so they told the non-union people separately from the union people. And the union rep, Amanda, read off the list of union people, and I was just in complete shock. I was like, did you just say, how can this be? And I also felt really, really incredibly fundamentally alone, because I had just moved there and just started a new job, so I knew barely anyone on a personal and professional level. And like, all these other people were like hugging one another and crying, and I was just sitting there in shock, like feeling very physically, emotionally, like in every way alone and totally fucked.
Wow.
It was a really intense experience, and I remember spending that entire weekend basically like sobbing. I didn't go to the inauguration. It felt like basically like maybe the worst breakup you could ever have. And then because I was union, I got 2 months notice. So it was like living with that ex who just dumped you heartlessly and coming to work every day and crying pretty much every day. It was really, really, really rough. I'm glad that that's over with.
Yeah. The drama of having names read off a list. It's like,
yeah. Didn't take anybody into an office separately or anything. It was just like, okay, here are those names.
Wow. I'm gonna just move through these things because I want to get to them. This question is basically, I'll just read it. The recent past has seen a series of horrific events that have brought racialized violence to the forefront of people's minds. How have you engaged with these conversations through your work, or how have they shaped your organization's approach, if at all?
Well, I just shared about like the abortion fund and the, I think like the work that they need to do. And maybe, I mean, I guess as a former board member and founder, I could take a lead role in encouraging them to do that. But here, like, it's been very frustrating because as the Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, we are the statutorily authorized leader on policy funding and research. If anyone in the state besides the governor, we should be the ones to say, like, this has got to stop and this needs to change and here are the resources to do it. Like, lead action plans and lead like community forums and put forth like press releases and briefs on this issue here. And it's not happening. And it's been a while, but I talked to my boss about it. She's a black woman. She has 2 black sons. She has a black daughter. She feels very strongly about this, but she's also like, I've tried to bridge this before, and I did bridge it with our executive director, who is also a black woman. And she's like, it's too politicized in this still very white conservative state with our white man governor, my conservative man governor.
Mm-hmm.
So basically nothing has happened, except that I think as part of the president's initiative, we did get some funding for like body-worn cameras or something, but I kind of think that that's bullshit. One thing that has been coming to the forefront of domestic violence organizations in the state is the disproportionate instances of domestic violence-related fatalities. That African-American women suffer from. And so I know that the Domestic Violence Coalition has recently done some like anti-racism workshopping and like actually had a consultant come down and work with their staff. And they've made it like a statewide priority for their agency to work on that. And even though I'll be gone by that time, in my role, I coordinate the state's, what's called our Stop Vow Implementation Plan. It's like a source of funds for domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking exclusively. And I'm working on planning workshops for anti-racism and another one for gender identity and sexual orientation, non-discrimination, how to comply with this new provision in the law in that regard. But the anti-racism one, I think is something that I think CJCC should do internally before we ask our sub-grantees to do it. But in my position, I can only offer that to sub-grantees.
Mm-hmm.
I can ask people, but I can't make them.
Mm-hmm. Do you go run the workshops, or do you have
bring in the experts? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And then they go to shelters and organizations and run work.
We'll convene them. Like, we have, we'll have a meeting here. For the coalition, though, they brought in the TA provider to work with them, just like one on one, so to speak, with their agency. But this will be like a group collaborative effort.
With the legalization of gay marriage, sort of the next thing is that has the LGBT rights movement. How does that movement intersect with your work or this organization of reproductive justice?
I think that it has impacted it a lot. I think that, well, okay, so just the immediate question of gay marriage. I think that has yet to fully bear out, but the fact that, I guess what I'm thinking of the most, maybe two things, is that the staff at the agencies we fund will need and should already have had training on equal treatment and non-discrimination. They also need to know how to ask the right questions in a respectful way to make sure they get the services they need, because now this will open up a large segment of the population who has been like deliberately disadvantaged and oppressed economically for their sexual orientation to be able to get social services. Because when they can link families through marriage, through that kind of partnership, they can in some ways like have more access and like navigate their bureaucracy more effectively to get those social services and like social funding assistance. I mean, that's what most immediately comes to mind, is like both the training and like helping them get the assistance within like the scope of work that I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's also gender identity training?
Yeah, definitely. I just didn't relate that to gay marriage necessarily, because it's thought of that more as like a sexual orientation issue, but I guess it can definitely impact.
Yeah, that's kind of just the next question about sexuality, sexual identity, and trans issues shaping your work.
Well, that, I mean, I kind of feel like in my role here as a state employee, like it's kind of frustrating sometimes, or like, I think I've snuck a lot of things in, and some of them, like, I didn't even sneak in, I just did them, and then people signed off on them. And then I didn't know that it was a big deal until people came up to me later and were like, "You're awesome, thank you." And I was like, "What?" Uh-huh. And they were like, you know, a couple of years ago, nobody would have done this. I really appreciate that. Like, the biggest example is for that same thing, the Stop VAWA implementation plan, where even though we're required to give statistics on, like, race and poverty and sexual orientation and, you know, all those identity markers, and I just did it. And we're like, here are the statistics, here are the disparities, here's why this is an issue in our state. Bam. And people were like astounded and grateful for that. And I was like, wow, I'm glad I made a difference, but it's discouraging to hear how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
That people were afraid to like speak out honestly about it, even just put it on paper. And then, I don't know, there's been other things, like one of my first little victories was on an intake form for a project I coordinated. I was editing their intake form, and I took out, like, the male and female box and wrote, like, gender identity in, like, blank space. But I don't know, that might be the most I've really done, except for just, like, you know, advocating for the training to be done in December, along with the anti-racism training. And I don't know, just whenever I feel it's appropriate, just pointing out, like, oh, this is a gender identity issue. Oh, I thought of one other thing. Recently, like, we have our subgrantees complete program reports, quarterly program reports on the use of the funds, and when they revamped the system about a year and a half ago, they went from, like, male, female, unknown categories to adding a transgender category, and it's one of the poorest reported statistics. And I think we, like me and the statistical team, think it's because people aren't asking that when they get on an intake form. They're just like, oh, like female. And then,
oh, like the intaker is just checking the box.
Yeah, they're not asking people to self-identify. We think the same is true for disability statistics, too.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, we've been training people on, like, the importance of self-identification for everyone, but also for victims to be like, this is an empowering thing, to be like, I am this person. And also, you can provide them with more appropriate services and referrals if you know what their values and what their accessibility issues are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing related to that, I think.
How about social media? How is that?
How's that going
for you? How has that changed or shaped your work? Benefits, challenges?
I think that it's I'm trying to think of how to say it. I think that being a part of Facebook specifically has enabled me to read and be exposed to other media outlets and other articles and resources about various issues involving and related to feminism that I wouldn't have encountered on my own. So I think that that has been a net gain. Some of the challenges might be, like, I don't think it's the most productive forum for the best forum for a productive and challenging dialogue. I think it's too easy for people to, like, slide into unproductive conflict.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the con, but the pro for me would be seeing, like, being exposed to so many new things.
Yeah, I think it's, I just, you know, I've interviewed one person a few years younger, a few years older, and, like, Facebook and social media is sort of like you've existed without it and with it, but sort of, like, come into the professional world basically with it, so.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting to think about social media in terms of the...
Yeah? Yeah? Hello?
Hey, it's Monique.
Come in. Oh, hey. Sorry.
Okay.
Hey.
So
how are you?
So
no, you're fine.
You said writing, though.
It's
I didn't
so
know
good
somebody...
to see you.
I'm
hello
not actually writing. I know. Like, it's just writing. That's what I was thinking about. Me. Like, oh, it's just writing. Okay, I just want to say
you
thank you for everything. And I just want to say I love you, and I'll email you or call you or whatever.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm
glad you stopped by.
Nice to meet you.
Okay, she used to work here. Oh, that's racy. She signed it the Nunnelies, a.k.a. Monique. this you're saying about social media?
I don't know. But, you know, more generally, what do you think's going on in the, you know, political climate today? How do you see that shaping your work? Like, what's going on either locally or nationally that affects you?
I think it's, like, an interesting, volatile time in politics. We're, like, coming out of the Obama presidency. I think a lot of, like, left and radical people feel really jaded, but also energized by the injustices that have been occurring. So it's like out of this profound disappointment in political leadership and society and the failure to change, there might be, like, hope and action and change coming from that. But at the same time, I also think there might be, like, a significant conservative backlash. So I guess I feel like rising tide, lifting all boats kind of thing. Like, it's it feels like things are escalating rapidly, but that it might not necessarily be, like, a left versus right kind of thing that will result in social progress. It just seems like those two things are in such,
mm-hmm,
I don't know.
What do you think it's meant to have Obama in the White House?
What has it meant to have Obama in the White House? I think
it's literally says, how has it shaped your work, if at all?
Well, I think that I'm not sure how it shaped the funding that I do now, but I think it is important, even though in a lot of ways I think he has been disappointing, I think it's been important to have somebody who is like publicly pro-choice, who has daughters. Probably the hugest thing for the work I do now is related to sexual assault. President Obama's leadership on sexual assault has had and will continue to have a huge impact on the awareness around this issue as like sexual and gender-based violence and funding, like changing people's attitudes and beliefs that this is not acceptable, and the amount of money that's going towards holding offenders accountable and serving victims. That has actually been a huge sea change.
Hmm.
And I hope that it continues.
Because of statements he's made?
Mm-hmm. I think statements he's made, and also like the leadership that he can have over the Department of Justice that releases a lot of funding for this issue. I think there's also funding from Health and Human Services, but in my role here, I'm not as familiar with that. I just mm-hmm. know from the DOJ side, there's mm-hmm. been an enormous increase in funding. Last year, for the sexual assault services, there were two grant programs related to sexual assault. That's when we started to see the upswing. And we applied for and got maybe like a little over $1 million. This year, it's over $3 million. That's big.
Triple.
Big.
Do you find it bizarre to have these huge numbers coming in out of this office?
I mean, yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
Yeah, if I thought that I could ever put on my resume that I manage grant programs totaling over, like aspects of grant programs totaling over $20 million, then you could have knocked me over with a feather. I didn't think about it or care, but now I'm like, huh.
Yeah. It seems like a huge amount, but then there's a lot of, I can see from this thing on your wall, there's a lot of organizations or issues that are where the funding's going.
Yeah, and this is all the decisions are made with markers on flip charts on the wall.
Uh-huh. In colors.
Yeah, it's good. Color-coded.
So how do you see your work in relation to the history of feminism? Yeah, I didn't want to have to deal with two different files, so I just left it running.
Okay.
But we can wrap. Basically, the last questions are about feminism, your thoughts on...
My thoughts on feminism.
Your relation to it, third wave terminology, challenges facing feminists, and your hopes. So whatever.
I don't even know anymore. This kind of stuff used to fascinate me, but like... The third versus fourth wave. We're probably like in the fourth or the fifth wave or something at this point. I don't even know what third wave is. Although I guess that, if anything, might resonate with me most. Because I associate that more with like a social and cultural, like punk ethos approach to feminism rather than like an academic thing. Although I guess that fed the academic sphere of feminism at the time. So yeah, I don't even know anymore. It's just like, it's almost overwhelming, but it's also encouraging and exciting where feminism is now, mm-hmm. at least as I think of it, or feminisms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think its challenges are?
I think the challenges are how to integrate like all the different feminisms and concerns and like identity politics to like unify and have a common goal, but I also don't think that that's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it will require and does require like a lot of different strategies and tackling oppression from different angles to get it done. I guess the biggest challenge I see, that I hate it when this happens, and I know I've been complicit in it, but is when, like, the goals of one group, of one oppressed group, come to, like, supersede or, like, push back the rights of another. And I guess, like, I'm trying to think of a more concrete example of it, but do I have to? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, when, like, I think it happens a lot in the reproductive rights movement because so many people, like I was saying earlier, and how it resonated with me in high school, associated with, like, cisgender, heterosexual women, like, getting pregnant, you need an abortion, you need contraception, whatever, and not, and that can, that view and that history can, like, eclipse, like, the more complex reproductive health and rights needs that other people have.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to add to this, that were gaps in your story or this issue of what's kind of going on today, that how that relates to feminism?
I don't know if I do. I don't think I have anything profound to say, just that this, you asking me to do this is an honor and comes at an interesting time in my life where I feel like sort of in college, maybe, like, feminism for me has ebbed and flowed as being in the forefront of my consciousness, and I feel like in college I took a break, so to speak, and then working here I thought I was taking a break and ended up bringing that with me, and now I want to get into that again in my next career move. I want to do work that relates more directly with the reproductive justice movement again. It's interesting how things flow in cycles like that, and how this interview feels like it's coming at a very significant time for me, and, like, talking about it and reflecting on it, which I almost never make time to do in, like, one cohesive sitting, is definitely inspiring me to explore that more. And also I feel like I've been speaking really broadly and just from my experience, and that I'm kind of out of touch with what's really been happening, and I need to, like, look outside of myself and listen more carefully, especially if I want to do this kind of work again in a meaningful way.
That kind of sums everything up, so I'm kind of hesitant to jump back in, but I have one kind of question, which is that you mentioned that I just like thinking of you as listening to Riot Grrrl music in Pensacola, and, like, that being a moment, and I don't know if you still listen to that kind of stuff, but, like, do you...
Yeah. When I started having a really hard time here at this job, one of the things that I took up about that same time was jogging or running, as it sounds more badass to call it, and listening to, like, my old, like, Riot Grrrl punk albums while I jogged, sometimes ran, and how much that, like, both fed and placated my anger and frustration.
So that goes in cycles too.
Yeah, maybe.
The Riot Grrrl.
Yeah,
I just think, you know, I never listened to that stuff, and then when I got to college and realized other people grew up listening to, like, bands of women, I was like, wow, that's like it's radical or something.
Yeah. My current boyfriend is really into music. He loves music so much, and he's exposed me to a lot, and it's brought music more to the forefront of my mind. And then, like, when I share my favorite music with him, or, like, am looking through music just, like, at work or something and trying to find new bands to listen to because I feel like I easily get stagnant in that, I'm like, oh, you know what, it seems like a Captain Obvious thing, but it's almost all exclusively, like, women fronted or women only bands
that you're drawn to.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's like the sound and, like, the content and the feel of it is just, you know, just makes more sense to me.
Mm.
Sounds pretty good. Sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah. And your parents must have been like, okay.
I don't think that they were.
Because I met them once.
That was really funny. I was thinking about that the other day.
Yeah.
And how, like, my parents at Lamont with your parents.
Yeah.
It was like two old
lesbians.
Yeah.
And two Republicans from Pensacola, and they hit it off. And we were just sitting there like, wow. That's my memory of it.
Yeah, pretty much me too.
Well, I really appreciate that you sat and shared and did this interview. And maybe there'll be more to follow up on, but I think we covered a lot.
Good deal.
So, cool.
I hope that it's good stuff for you and your professor.
Yeah.